Hello, good morning. Yeah, so firstly, for those of you who did do the character course, I know there's quite a few of you here, thank you so much for being involved in that. You probably were aware as you did it that that was a pilot of the course, which meant it's basically like a brown paper bag version of it. We throw it out there and we just see what happens. And so about 1,000 people did that in the first half of this year across the UK. And I now have mountains and mountains of feedback in terms of what worked, what didn't, what we need to change, what we should change, what shouldn't change, etc. Which, to be honest, is really hard to make sense of. But thank you very much for kind of doing it and just taking the risk on us in that area. And that goes out on international release early in the new year once we've managed to process all the things that were involved in it. Now, this morning, Matt was asking me, what is the title of your talk? Because we like to put it on the screens and kind of, you know, make sure people know what it is. And I said, do you know what? I don't know. If I was downloading this off iTunes, it would be called Untitled Track Number One. partly because I've been on a bit of journey that I'll talk about a bit in the talk, about what transformation really means. I know you've been talking about that a lot. And my experience really is that quite often I don't know what it is that God is going to require of me in any given day. You know, I don't always know where am I going to be led, where's the opportunity going to emerge. And it's so fascinating that Matt talked about, you know, this awareness of God already being present. Because if I'm honest, that's my big revelation this year, is that God is always present. And what we have to do is make ourselves present to his presence. And if you go back in history and you go back, to the foundation of the Benedictines, it's almost 1,500 years ago, monastic life started in the desert. Benedict had this thing that he called the 12 steps of humility. In other words, how to base your life on a humble relationship with God. In fact, he had some really nice ways of putting it. He used to say, he is either a fool or a madman. There's a few of those around here we heard. Yeah. He is a fool or a madman who does not base his life on humility. And the first step of humility in his kind of view was beginning to cultivate the constant awareness of God's presence. Because he had this idea that knowing that God was present has a transformational effect on us. And that when we know that God is present, not only does our sin start to reduce, actually, because you're feeding off God all the time, but also we then start to have a transformational effect on the people around us. So one of the kind of upshots of that for today is, I don't quite know where I'm going to go today. I've done a lot of work on my talk today. I've never given it before, put hours into it, prayed a lot. And at the end of it, I'm like, I better just tell you that because I don't know if you're going to notice as we go along. Because usually I like to have things quite locked down. I know exactly where we're going to go and what we're going to do. But today I'm not quite sure. So let's see how we get on and let's just sort of work with God as we go along. So I'm a psychologist, as some of you will know. I also chair an organization called the Network of Christians in Psychology, which is a UK organization. There's about 220 Christian psychologists in the UK who sort of meet together and pray and think about how psychology and faith fit together. And one of the consequences of my name being on their website is that sometimes I get really, really weird emails. 2 weeks ago, I got an email from the BBC, and they said, we would like you to go on the BBC and comment on a story that's just broken. I'm like, okay, sounds great. And they said, would you be free between 7 a.m. and 9 a.m. last Sunday morning? I'm like, yeah, I'm free then. And I thought they were saying you'll be on the radio between 7 a.m. and 9 a.m., but no, it turned out that between 7 a.m. and 9 a.m., every single local BBC station was going to phone me for 6 minutes and ask the same questions. I'm like, great, I wish I'd known that when I signed up for this. And if you're ever dealing with media in those kind of situations, the best thing to do is just send them the questions you want them to ask you so you're not guessing. If you ask me these questions, you'll get a good response. And here's what had just broken. Virgin Media had just done a piece of research where they'd looked at what character you played in the nativity play as a kid and what that predicted you would become later in life. So if you're Mary, you know what, you're going to be really popular on social media. If you're a king, I was a king, apparently I'm destined for a career in construction. That hasn't happened yet. If you played the ox, well, you're probably going to be the highest earning member of the cast in the future. So they're asking me all these questions. They're like, what do you make of it? I'm like, well, it's complete nonsense, isn't it? It's just complete rubbish. So I gave them a set of questions that I could answer about it. And the final one was a question that effectively said, and is there a deeper spiritual significance to the Nativity play? And the first three questions, pretty much every station messed up. Like, they got confused about, asked them in the wrong order, got it all wrong. But then the final question, they all landed perfectly. So at the end of this sort of six-minute interview, I get about 40 seconds just to talk about Jesus and talk about how, yes, there is something much deeper in the Nativity. If you want to look for it, it is there. And in fact, there's even adult exercises. If you think about the Jesuits, the kind of Roman Catholic order, that used to do all kinds of spiritual exercises around prayer, one of the exercises they used to do was imagine yourself at the Nativity. Imagine yourself being, maybe not Jesus, but some of the other characters there, and what it would have been like to observe that and be there. And so I'm talking about this, I'm saying, yes, there is this deep idea to the Nativity. And today, because traditionally, 1st of December, this would be Advent Sunday. We'd be lighting the first candle of Christmas. So I thought, well, let's actually talk a little bit about Advent. Because if we're thinking about God's presence, and we're thinking about that being transformational, then Advent really is the time when we celebrate that idea. It's not just that Jesus came once, it's just that he keeps arriving and he stays present and we meet him time and time and time again. And Advent is a really good time to remind ourselves of that. So Advent is the time when we celebrate that our waiting will have an end. You waiting for anything? Ever been in a period of pain or difficulty or suffering? And you're kind of saying to God, I just wish this would come to an end. Maybe there's debt. Maybe there's problems in your family. Maybe there's been relationship breakdowns. Maybe bereavement. But a period of like, I have to wait. And I just want to see where God takes me with this. And very often when we light the first candle of Christmas, sometimes we will quote the second chapter of John, verse 5. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. Some will say the darkness cannot put it out. It's this idea of Jesus is shining. He's shining right now. He's shining in history. He's shining in our hearts. And no matter how dark things get around us, that will not die. It won't go away, even if we feel that it might, even if we feel that it's under threat. And so it's this sort of weird thing at Advent. I grew up in quite a traditional church, and therefore, you know, you quite often had a dark church and people would light the candle. And it had this kind of strange atmosphere. On the one hand, it was kind of quite sad and quite mournful and almost a little bit spooky. It's kind of like, this is sort of, there's something scary and wonderful about this. And then on the other hand, it's really hopeful and fantastic because we light this candle and we go, isn't that beautiful? It's like this beauty in all the difficulty and the pain of the world. And my feeling about Advent, therefore, is it sort of reflects the way we often live life, which is very often hopeful and mournful at the same time. You may, there's a parable that the theologian Tom Wright talks about, and he talks about how life contains both wonderful things and terrible things. And he tells this parable about the two philosophers who are raised in a cave, and they come out one day and they see the world. One of them bursts into tears and the other laughs his head off. And it's like both those things are true about our lives. That's the way life worked. And so today, I'd like to just talk about what we do in those moments of waiting. What we do when sometimes we don't have a story of short-term victory. You know how sometimes we like a kind of story where this happened, then I got healed, then way off we go, it's all great. But don't necessarily always know to do with, yeah, this is grinding on, I can't actually see an end to it. And what do I do in some of those moments? And ultimately, I guess, what I want to talk about is what does it mean to hold on when some of the things we've traditionally looked to support us, to look after us, that made us feel safe and happy and okay in the world, go a bit missing? Because that's what Advent is about. There's the darkness, but there's a light in the darkness. So, you remember the Bible, yeah? The New Testament, four Gospels in the Bible, and each Gospel has its own little quirks, own little features. They're kind of like, you know, different people writing about Jesus, taking slightly different angles. So you get to Mark's Gospel, and Mark's Gospel is like an action movie. His favorite word is immediately. We do this, then we do that. Jesus did this. Mark tells us this is what Jesus did. It's very sort of manly. and exciting. And then Matthew's Gospel. Matthew's Gospel is kind of like a bit of an educational film. He wants to teach us a few things. He bases the whole Gospel around five big blocks of teaching that Jesus did. The early church sort of sometimes used it as an instruction manual for them. So module one, Sermon on the Mount. You know, you can imagine it as a series of tapes or something like that. So Mark's like, this is what Jesus did. Matthew is, this is what Jesus did and what he said. And then John's Gospel. It's a bit weird, isn't it? John's Gospel, it's like a foreign language film. You know what I mean? It's kind of like, what's going on? You know, it'd have loads of voiceovers and husky internal monologues. It's like some kind of Givenchy advert, you know, where there's attractive people. In the beginning was the word. No, I've got no idea what that accent is, to be honest. In the beginning was the word, and the word was with God, and the word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things, you know, and it goes on, you know. It's that kind of thing. So it's almost like you have to read every chapter about 50 times to work out what is going on here. What's John trying to say? So Mark is like, this is what Jesus did. Matthew is like, this is what Jesus did, and this is what he said. And John is, this is what Jesus did, this is what he said, and this is what he meant. And he says, and I haven't got to the end of that, because he says at the end, and if I was going to write about everything, the books would take up the whole world. Like, thanks, John, for not afflicting that on us. So it's kind of like, the different things. So Mark is an action film. Matthew is like educational. John is like this sort of foreign language, sort of indie flick. And then Luke's Gospel. Luke's Gospel. They call it the Gospel of Joy because he uses the word joy. There's all kinds of joy going on. And to be honest, because everyone's so irritatingly upbeat all the way through the Gospel, everyone's like leaping for joy and getting exciting. And basically, Luke's Gospel is a musical. That's what it is. Everyone's bursting into song all over the place. I actually once wrote a short musical. It was called The Things I Hate About Musicals. And one of the things I hate most about musicals is people sing stuff they could just say. Like, why do you have to sing? Can you just say that? And then when you look in Luke's Gospel, that's exactly what's going on. So, you know, in every other Gospel, the angels are quite happy just to tell people stuff. But in Luke's Gospel, they appear in the sky and they're singing glory to God in the highest. And it's like full West End production for some shepherds who are just sat there going, lads, is it just me? Or can you see this too? What's going on here? You know. And then when Mary becomes pregnant, she goes to Elizabeth and she sings, you know, God's been so good to me and all this kind of thing. It just goes on, you know, right? And the other thing about Luke, I don't know if you know this, is that whereas in all the Gospels, Jesus kind of is quite sort of deliberate and speaks in these sort of fairly concise sentences, Luke loves the stories of Jesus. We have parables from Jesus in Luke that don't appear in any other Gospel. But the thing that's really weird about it is for about 10 chapters in the middle of Luke, you might not know this, Jesus kind of gets lost. So like it just tells story after story after story. And every time he tells a story, he's in a different geographical location that doesn't match up to the last one. So in every other Gospel, Jesus has this kind of clear path through Galilee. In Luke's Gospel, he's like all over the place. And do you know what that is? In a musical, it's a montage, isn't it? Paris, London, Judea. You know, it's just like just dancing around the place because all that matters is these wonderful, 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 wonderful stories. Let's get them across. And then the other thing about Luke is just when you think he's done, there's a flipping sequel. I mean, it's not as good as the original, obviously, but Acts of the Apostle comes along, and it's the same thing all over again. So the Acts of the Apostles, if you read it closely, is structured around speeches, performance pieces by Peter and Stephen and Paul, and these really, really important moments. And you know when they're about to speak, because if you read the Acts of the Apostles, it always said, they motioned with their hand. And then they speak. They motioned with his hand. Paul motioned to the crowd with his hand. You ever notice that when you read an act that everyone's like jazz hands all the way through? It's like, come on, guys. Luke, what is going on here? And the thing is, so Luke has this hugely joyful, musical, wonderful way of talking about things. But what's fascinating about Luke is that very often the joy and the wonder and the fantastic things that are going on very often have a sort of tragic edge to them. The wonder is, we thought the world was like this, but actually now, thanks to Jesus, we know it's like this. It's like this kind of wonderful sense of hope about it. And in a sense, in Advent, we celebrate the idea of God just coming and interrupting us and our usual way of the world. We, you know, sometimes you look at the news and you think, man, things are bad. what is going on here? Last summer, we spent some time in Ireland and saw, you know, a huge bushfire that took place right across the north of Ireland. And as you watch, just all this smoke rising into the sky, just that sense of, is the world burning? Is this as bad as it looks? So just, you know, just being right up close to it like that, houses being destroyed, didn't really hit the news here at all. But there it was. And so we have this sense of the world feels hard, it feels tough, it feels difficult. But then Luke comes and says, but there's something joyful, there's a light in this darkness that you can focus on. So over the last first half of this year, basically, I was going to different churches, sort of launching the character course in different places and talking about character and talking about what it meant, which meant that effectively I kind of gave the same talk over and over and over again in lots of different churches. I got to the end of the very, very last one. And weirdly, you know, sometimes that there'll be a prayer in your life that sort of emerges over a period of time. And when I was in my 20s, I had a particular prayer that I would often pray. I would say, God, make me into the person you need me to be. And kind of do whatever you need to do with me to turn me into what you need me to be. It was a regular prayer. It was right in my heart. And I just find myself spitting it out all the time and just living with it. And then when I hit that was kind of in my 20s. And then when I hit my 30s, I just felt I didn't need to pray that prayer anymore. It just sort of went away. Wasn't quite so important to me. And then in my 40s, as my eldest son starts to hit teenage years, I found that another prayer started to emerge. And my prayer now is, God, do whatever you need to do with me to make me into the father you need me to be. Because I'm like, I've never been here before and I really don't know what I'm doing. So please help me, God. And that kind of thing about fatherhood was really beginning to grow in me big time over the first half of this year, this sense of, God, I need you to kind of help me step up and become the father, to become the leader, if you like, to become the person who encourages others. I need you to help me be fatherly in the way that you are fatherly. And that had been growing and growing and growing in me as the kind of character course went on, as I sort of spoke to these different churches. And then literally the final church I launched in, church in Lincoln called Bridge Church, got to the end of the talk. I stood down off the platform, and my wife was at the back of this church. It's not our church at home. There she is. I'm like, what are you doing here? And she just came up and she gave me a big hug and she said, Roger, it's your dad. And what happened that morning is my mum had woken up. My dad said he was feeling a bit ill. This is May the 19th. He said, I just don't think I can go to church this morning. I don't feel well. I'm going to go back to bed. And then when my mum came back home later, he just died in his sleep, just gone. Really suddenly. Turned out to be a heart attack. And it was just one of those huge moments of interruption. Well, I thought I had, I mean, he's in his 70s, but I was seeing, you know, 10, 15 years ahead of us together. And it was like, wow, there we go, just an interruption like that. And the thing is, we don't always realize how deeply some of those things affect us. For me, almost the definition of grief for me now has become that thing you thought was over, but then it's not. It's like, I thought I was done with this. Oh, no, we're not. Here's another wave. Oh, I thought I was done with this. No, here we go again. It's another wave. And it put me in this really, really sort of interesting place where, again, I just found myself just really seeking deeply the presence of God again and saying, God, I just need you to carry me through this period of time. Molly, can I just say as well, I was talking to my mum on the phone last night, and I gave her your book. And just last night she said, that book's really, really helped me. And I said, well, I might be seeing Molly tomorrow, so I'll just tell her. So just to say thank you, it's really, really helped her kind of deal with that period of time. And so it's like suddenly you don't have the future in front of you that you thought you had. I also find I no longer have the front I used to have in terms of, like, there were lots of things in my diary I just had to cancel because I'm just like, just don't really have it in me to kind of do whatever it is to get into that thing right now. And you find yourself in this kind of really strange place where nevertheless, suddenly, for me anyway, I just encountered the deep presence and appreciation of God. So you find yourself in one of those moments where you're waiting. Can't be fixed easily. Isn't going to be changed instantly. Just is what it is, and you've got to walk through it with God as you go along. And getting back to Luke, there's a story in Luke that tells us about what kind of attitude helps us when we're waiting in moments like that, when life feels hard, when life feels tough, when sometimes, yes, God transforms a situation, sometimes God transforms us within the situation. What are those moments like? So it's in Luke chapter 2, verse 22, the Advent story. So this is, Jesus has been born, Mary and Joseph are now going to take him for his purification. So this is the time to take him, kind of like, it's like his sort of dedication moment. So chapter 2, verse 22. I think it's chapter 2 anyway. Yes, it is, yep. And when the time came for their purification, according to the law of Moses, they brought Jesus up to Jerusalem to present him to the Lord. As it is written in the law of the Lord, every male who first opens the womb shall be called holy to the Lord. And to offer a sacrifice according to what is said in the law, a pair of turtle doves and two young pigeons. Now, I think this is one of the most charming stories in the whole Bible. There was a man in Jerusalem whose name was Simeon. And this man was righteous and devout, waiting for the consolation of Israel. And the Holy Spirit was upon him. And it had been revealed to him by the Holy Spirit that he would not see death before he'd seen the Lord's Christ. And he came in the Spirit into the temple, and when the parents brought in the child Jesus to do for him according to the custom of the law, he took him up in his arms, steals the baby, and blessed God, and said, Lord, now you are letting your servant depart in peace, according to your word. For my eyes have seen your salvation, that you have prepared in the presence of all peoples, a light for revelation to the Gentiles, and for glory to your people Israel. Doesn't really tell us how old he is. I sometimes imagine a guy in his 70s or 80s, maybe, who's been hanging around, who's waiting, who's kind of seeing, will I see this? There's maybe even some doubt in him about whether he's really going to see what God has promised for him. He's in that place of waiting. And then if you follow the story on, you know that he then prophesies over the parents, and then we get another lovely story again about Anna, the widow who lost her husband when she was very young, and ever since she's been waiting and praying in the temple, and she too gets to see the Messiah, gets to see Jesus. It's this really, really charming story about a moment of waiting that's painful and difficult and doubtful, and yet ends with this beautiful thing of there's Jesus, there's what he's about. And the interesting thing, and this is why I did my whole thing on Luke being so joyful, is there's a particular word that Luke uses about this guy, about Simeon, that no other gospel writer uses. So Luke uses it in Luke, and he uses it in Acts. And it's the word that we translate sometimes as devout, sometimes as reverend, sometimes as godly. And it's the word, how do I pronounce it? It's pronounced, I haven't written it down. So let's forget how it's pronounced. No, it's pronounced, where's it gone? I told you this was a bit of a mess. Well, it's basically a combination of two words. And one word means good, you. So it's the word we have in the Good News, in the word Eucharist. It means good, it means well. And the other word is the word that means held, lambano, to hold something. And so this word for devout, this word for godliness, effectively means to hold something well. It's kind of the idea of, all kinds of things are going on, but you're going to hold on in some way. Kind of reminds me a little bit about when I was a kid and I was first learning to play cricket. I'd go in the garden, I was about 10 years old, and I was first learning to play cricket with those balls that can break your fingers if you catch them wrongly. And my dad would throw a ball at me and I'd miss it, and then he'd throw one that would hit me on the head, and then he'd throw another one. And eventually I'd get to catch it, and my dad would go, well held, well done, well held. It's like, how do you hold on to your faith? The other image that kind of comes to mind as well, you know, if you've ever been standing on a bus or something like that, and there's a corner coming, and, if you're not holding on, you're going to be thrown all over the place, but actually, you know, the corner comes and that moment comes, and you just hold on to the bar at the right moment, and it's like, well held, you held on. The friction came your way, the turbulence, the turn came your way, but you're holding on in that way. And the thing about Luke is, because he's a writer of joy, his joyfulness means that he spots things in people that some of the other writers don't spot. So this word, well held, you lambo, Luke really likes it. So I've got the word here. It's eulabes is the word. So at Pentecost, when he's talking about all the people in the city, saying there's people here from all over the world, in the apostle, in the Acts, he says they were devout men. In other words, they're from everywhere, but these people hold God. They hold their faith in a certain way. And then when Stephen is stoned, so Stephen often viewed as the kind of first martyr in history, when Stephen is stoned, there's a little section just before it goes on about how Paul went off to murder Christians. Just before that, he says, but devout men buried Stephen. It's like this contrast. The people who'd got it, they held it, they knew it. Even though it's tragic and difficult and hard, they went and they buried Stephen respectfully. And the contrast is, and Paul was off out the door to go and murder Christians. It's like this sense of holding on, well held. And then the other person it's used of is Ananias. So you know the story of Paul. Paul falls off his donkey, big bright light. He goes blind. And the only way that he can actually be sorted out is if some poor Christian is convinced by God to go and talk to this guy who's been murdering everybody. It's like the equivalent, you know, of someone being sent to, and you've heard stories like, you know, go and speak to this person from ISIS. I've heard Christians talk about God directing them. ISIS, Taliban, people who theoretically should kill them, but God's saying, go and speak to this person. And Ananias is described in the same way. Eulabes, holding on. He holds on. He knows what it's about. Even though everything in him is really saying, this is not a good situation. I shouldn't really be here talking to this guy, praying for him to be healed. But God says, no, because you're devout, you've got it. You'll walk with it. So it's the ability to hold our faith, our relationship to God, gently but firmly, even when everything else conspires against us to loosen it, to loosen our grip. It's the idea of holding on when we're most tempted to let go. We nurture and protect what God has promised us, even if we don't always know why. We have a bit of a tradition in our family where if it's your birthday, you get woken up at some godly hour in the morning with people singing and a birthday cake. It's supposed to be a blessing. I'm not always sure it is, but you know that's what we go with. This year, because we like to do something fancy, for my wife, we got her some champagne to wake up with. And we also had one of those kind of big sparkler torches on it. So it's not just a candle. When you light it, it basically takes the roof off. It was like, we thought this would be fun. It now looks like a fire hazard. We're not quite sure what's going on here. And this idea of holding, you ever notice when you light candles on a birthday cake and then you're carrying it into something's room or you're carrying someone, you conceal the candle. You just kind of conceal it for a while. You hide it. You keep it with you. You hold on to it. And it's so that it doesn't go out while you're moving around. And it's almost like those are the moments where actually sometimes, you know, when life is difficult, we just have to conceal our passion. Hold it close. Nurture it. Make sure it's okay. C.S. Lewis used to call it the law of undulation. This idea that, you know, your spiritual life does go up and down. You know, we have moments of consolation where God feels deeply close, moments of desolation when God feels far away. And you know what? That's normal. You know, that's nothing weird. When I was a kid and I was first getting to know God as a teenager, I used to get really annoyed that some days I'd feel hugely blessed by God and the next day, where was he? I felt really absent. Have I done something wrong? What's gone on? I just didn't really talk to anyone about it. And I wish I had, because someone would go, oh yeah, that's how this works. That's the deal. That's what following God is about. So well held, we hold on to what God has promised us, even if we don't always know why or what's going on or what's going on around us. Now, the interesting thing is that there's only other two, outside of Luke's writing, there's only other two passages in the whole Bible where these words occur. And they're both in the book of Hebrews, and they kind of tell us what we do with that word. How do we make those things work for us? The first thing is that the writer of the Hebrews, in Hebrews 5, verse 7, uses this word of Jesus. So he refers to Jesus. And in chapter 5, he says this, in the days of his flesh, Jesus offered up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death. And he was heard because of his reverence, devoutness, godliness. That's the word. He was heard because of these things. He was heard because he could hold on. So here's one of the things I would suggest to you around holding on when we look at Jesus, is that we all have moments of closeness with God. We have moments where God, we feel blessed. We feel like God is close. We feel like spiritually he's all over us and we can sense his presence. Sometimes those moments, they're really hard to hold on to. But I would say, firstly, when you're in those moments, just make sure you remember them. Savor them. Enjoy them. Write them down somewhere. Just let God know that you really, really appreciate what's going on in that moment. And then when you have other moments that aren't quite like that, just be ready to go back to it. Because quite often you can plan in those moments of wonderful closeness with God what you might do later when he's far away. So you don't live, and God is never far away, but it feels that way. So you can plan in those moments of kind of consolation, of closeness, of proximity, of intimacy with God. God, I know these moments don't last forever, but I just want to hold on to this, and I'm going to think on this, you know, next Tuesday when I'm in some boring meeting at work. I will remember this moment and remember that it's true. So it says Jesus was heard because of his reverence. And the thing we're told there is because if you hold on to those things, it reminds you that even when you feel like your prayers are bouncing off the ceiling, they're being heard. God is listening. He is drawing close. He is interested. That even if we are faithless, he remains faithful. That's in his nature. He can't be any other way. That is the way it is. So we have it of Jesus. I think the other thing this tells us about Jesus as well is that the writer of the Hebrews is really clear that one of the reasons that Jesus is so wonderful, one of the many reasons, is that he persisted to the point of death. So he remained true to everything God had given him, even though absolutely everything in life was stripped away from him, in physical pain, in agony, in psychological torture, in all these kind of ways. He went through it all, and yet he held onto it. And that's the other thing I would say, is if you ever find yourself in those moments when God feels distant, or things feel hard, or things feel difficult, never change a spiritual commitment you've made in a moment of difficulty like that. So never decide this is the moment to change my job. This is the moment to have an argument with someone. This is the moment to, I usually pray, but I'm not going to pray now because I'm feeling in this state. If anything, maybe you should pray just a little bit more in those moments. But when you find yourself in those moments, that isn't the moment to go for a change. That's the moment to persist and keep going and see what's going on. And also, knowing that Jesus has been through that situation, I sometimes find that those moments are sometimes the hardest moments for me to pray to God, to actually request something. But as I've been, as I've been sort of praying and thinking over the course of this year, what I've discovered is it's amazing, even when God feels distant, even when you might be struggling for temptation, just to say, Jesus, help me with this. And the answer may not come immediately, but sometimes it does. Sometimes literally that's the moment someone knocks on the door or something pops up on your phone or you read something. Or may, sometimes I find 5 minutes later somebody says something or something happens that is like that's kind of freeing me from this moment. So even in those moments when you feel things are difficult and things are hard, those can be actually the best moments to make a petition to God. And in a sense, that's what this is saying of Jesus. In his pain and his tears, and the image there is the Garden of Gethsemane, where Jesus is really trying to negotiate with God. I don't really want to go to the cross. Can I do something else? And God is saying, no, hold with it, Jesus. Stay in there. His father's saying that to him. And those can be the moments when we offer a petition. So we take that from Jesus. He's heard. He's heard when he's holding on, when he's in that moment. And then the other thing, the other time the writer of the Hebrews uses it, is about us. It's about us as followers of Jesus. And what does that mean? So in Hebrews chapter 12, verse 28, he says, therefore, let us be grateful for receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken. And thus let us offer to God acceptable worship with reverence and with awe. He's talking to people who are in difficulty, they're being persecuted, they're finding life really hard, and he's saying this is the moment to pray and to worship and to hold on with reverence and awe and realize that what you have in God is ultimately more unshakable than anything else that goes on around it. So it's sort of suggested that we should be equally unwavering as God is. So what it's really saying is that God is unshakable and God holds on. God is showing patience all the time. He's fatherly, caring for us at every given moment. He's with us every step of the way. And the writer of the Hebrews here is saying, and let us offer God acceptable worship with reverence and awe. In other words, let's hold on to God in the same way that he holds on to us. So it's this idea that being devout implies an inner settlement, that something just is the way it is. It's like almost finding a place of rest inside. God is just there, and I'm going to behave that way, and I'm going to go with that, no matter what the circumstances are. It's that actually God is more stable than any pressure that comes our way. So I think when we think about God in this way, we have to sort of move away from viewing God as a form of technology. I think we're so exposed to all kinds of technology that so this morning, for example, I had to try my car three times, ignition three times before it started, because it was cold, needed to get it warmed up and going. And I'm thinking, ooh, is that a problem? Maybe I need to go and get it checked out, etc. The thing with God, though, is you can pray to God three times and sometimes nothing happens. So it's not a kind of technology that we have. Life with God is more like the way in which we water a plant or the way in which a child grows. It's like God in every minute bringing the nutrients, bringing the sustenance, bringing what we need to us. That's why the Bible is so, so full of so many agricultural metaphors about growth and development and those kind of things. And one of my favorite stories that for me really kind of sums up all the stuff that I've been talking about is, some of you will have read the work of Henry Nguyen. He's a sort of famous spiritual writer, Christian, wrote about all kinds of things. You know, he was super, super intelligent, Harvard, Yale University, and then he felt the call of God to actually go and live with people with learning disabilities and live with them in the last few years of his life, and that's what he did. And there's this wonderful story of one day he finally gets to meet Mother Teresa, his big hero. He's going to go and hang out with Mother Teresa. And he sits down with her, and for 10 minutes, he's blithering on about what he wants and how he's confused and where things are going and should he do this and should he do that. And after a while, he just sort of lapses into silence because he feels a bit embarrassed that he's gone on about all these problems and everything that he's going on. And he says Mother Teresa is silent for about 30 seconds, which is probably quite an awkward gap. She just sits there in silence. And then at the end of it, she says, "You know what, Henry? I think if you spend an hour each day in devotion to the Lord and don't do anything that you know to be wrong, you'll probably be all right." And I think if I'm going to land my talk anywhere, that's where I land it. It's just to encourage you this Advent, this Christmas, just to make yourself present again to God's presence. Say, God, it's good to have that reminder. It's good to light that candle in the darkness. It's good to have those moments where we say, God, you know, I don't always feel your presence, but that doesn't mean you're absent. It seems to me that one of the biggest lies, ultimately, that we've been sold, particularly by secular culture, is that the atmosphere around us is empty. Is that God isn't here, that he's absent in some way. And since I've been on this journey, one of the things I'm starting to do at the university where I work is I'm beginning to gather together staff. And once a month for a lunchtime, sometimes we only manage about 20 minutes, we just sit in the presence of God. And then we pray out of whatever it is that God has put on our hearts.